Welcome to this month's Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. David Rico first came to my attention when I interviewed him a couple of years ago on his book, How to Be an Adult in Relationships. He's also authored How to Be an Adult and Wisdom's Way, a book of quotations I find myself turning to often, as well as other books I'm sure you can access on his website, daverico.com. That's daverico.com. His new book, The 5 Things We Cannot Change and the Happiness We Find by Embracing Them, published by Shambhala and out January 11th, is the point of reference for today's interview. Dr. Rico is a psychotherapist, teacher, and writer, drawing on Jungian, Buddhist, and poetic perspectives in his work. His newest offering consists of online classes on relationships. You can go to teachingassistant.com and then to his website, daverico.com, to register. I'd like to welcome Dave to our show today.
Hi, Bella.
Hello there.
Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you again. Dave, can we start with the simplest of questions? What are these 5 things we cannot change that you speak of?
Well, I refer to these as the 5 givens of life, facts that all of us have noticed and about which we realize that we have no control over them. And the 5 particular givens are that in the course of life, things change and end. Secondly, that things don't always go according to our plans. Third, that suffering is part of life. Fourth, that people are not loving and loyal all the time. And finally, that life is not always fair.
Well, that's a bummer.
You've noticed that these happen over and over?
Yes, I do. It's really, you know, it's a wonderful way that you have of kind of weaving Buddhism and psychology together, and also the little table that you have in the book that kind of like, these are the givens, and these are our fears in the face of what these givens are. And, of course, I can't imagine anyone not having fear about these things, mm-hmm. How we mask it, and then, you know, how we can move or say yes to it. And so I like the way that you lay that out. We'll get back into these, I'm sure, time and again in the interview, but can we discuss the difficulties that we face with, well, what I would think we would both agree to call adult models of spirituality due to Western psychology's focus on the self, the difficulties we face with these more mature spiritual models?
First of all, mostly because of our conventional religious training from our childhood, we were taught that there's a God who somehow might rescue us from givens like these so that we would not have to face them. For instance, we might, even though it may never have been said specifically, we might have gotten the impression that if we do everything we're supposed to do, and if we lead a good life, and if we follow all the rules, then things will go well for us. So this would make us ask the question, well, then why did I get a diagnosis of cancer? Or why did my spouse leave me? It's hard to understand that part of becoming an adult is accepting the things that happen in life, and to realize that suffering is not a reward or a punishment, and joy is not a reward or a punishment. It's all, it's just simply happening, and it's up to us to make the best of it. And the first way to make the best of it is to come in with an attitude of, there will be no special exemption granted to me because I've been a good person. And that's the adult part of it. It's more like a child's view of the world to say, well, I did well, so give me a star. I did well, so buy me an ice cream cone. But as you become an adult, you realize it isn't set up that way. That's not the rule by which the universe is governed. things simply happen to us, and we have to go with the program, as St. Paul says about Jesus. In him, there was only yes. He simply said yes to everything that would come along. And that takes a big adult commitment. What is it a commitment to? It's a commitment to reality as it is, as opposed to the way we would like to shape it. I'm thinking of that stanza from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Ah, love, if you and I could but conspire to change this sorry scheme of things entire, would we not shatter it to bits and mold it nearer to the heart's desire? So there's something in us that wants to do that. It wants to change the way it is, to make it fair, to make people loyal and loving, to make sure that things don't change, etc. And those are wishes that come from the child part of us. The adult part is the part that has finally relaxed into the continually changing realities and has even relaxed into the fact that they're not always so pleasant.
Right.
Does that kind of cover what you were asking?
Yeah, it does.
I'm sorry, I don't have better news.
No. Well, you know, what are you going to do? No, I find that since I kind of embrace this, you know, existential kind of way of living, you know, you just face what exists. And then, you know, what then? This being the case, how do we proceed, right? Or how do I proceed?
Mm-hmm.
The Zen saying. You know, I've certainly grown up in ways I never expected to, I guess. But, it, you know, it doesn't stop the challenging nature of, you know, that's brought up in relationship with anything outside of, you know, myself inside one room inside my house. And even then I have to sit with myself. So, you know, it's going to come up there. I had a professor at Vermont College, and sometime or another, I'm sure I mentioned this on the program, she gave me a couple of tips or a couple of words to use instead of why. You know, why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? And they're how and what. And when I started kind of using those words in my life, things really began to shift and deepen. You know, instead of saying, well, why does this happen? Well, how can I work with this? I think in a way it's your yes, you know, it's a way of saying mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah. And this isn't the yes of surrender in the sense that I am simply going to go along with this and realize that there's nothing I can do about it. We do the best we can with what we're presented. But this is the yes of alignment. I align myself to the reality, trusting that if this is what's happening, this must be where I need to learn my lessons.
Right.
And I say that as a person of faith because I don't have any scientific evidence for that. It just seems like that's how it's been in the course of all our lives.
Yeah,
that we've learned our best lessons in most painful contexts.
Definitely. And I'm not sure science is all that useful when it comes to the human spirit, but...
Mm-hmm. And also I think that the, you know, you mentioned human spirit. We're the kinds of people who are enormously creative. And I think givens like the five that I mentioned are all sources of creativity.
Yeah. I really like that you identify core feelings, sadness, anger, fear, exuberance, or some variation of those four. Because I think a lot of us get confused between feelings, you know, those core emotions, and beliefs. And I'd love it if you talk a little bit about that.
Sure. First of all, you're referring to my separate chapter on feelings, you know, how we could say yes to feelings. And I begin by saying that all of us humans have feelings that need to come up pretty much on a daily basis. But the only way that our feelings will come up in an uninhibited way is if we feel safe to express them. this means that it has to be okay with the people around us that we show our feelings, and it begins in childhood. Was it okay with our mother or father that we would show our feelings, or did they put us down for having feelings or try to talk us out of them? And I take the word safe, S-A-F-E, to identify the four main feelings. S, sadness, A, anger, F, fear, E, exuberance, or joy. Now you have to ask yourself, if you think back to your childhood, was it always okay for you to be afraid? Or did your parents say things like, well, there's nothing to be afraid of, don't be a sissy? Was it always okay to be angry? Or did they slap you down if you were angry? Was it always okay to be sad? Or did they say, there's nothing to cry about, or I'll give you something to cry about? Was it always okay to be exuberant? Or did they say things like, watch out now, because after laughter comes tears? Then in an adult relationship, I imagine that the real meaning of intimacy is that those same four feelings become completely safe between the partners. So we can always express any of those four to each other and trust that love goes on, even when I'm angry and so forth. Now, in English, we use the word feel sometimes not to refer to those four feelings I just mentioned, sadness, anger, fear, and exuberance, but we sometimes use the word feeling to refer to a belief or a need or a sensation, and I'll give an example. We say, I feel he's the best candidate. That isn't really a feeling. What you mean is, I believe he's the best candidate. We say, I feel like being held, but really it's, I need to be held. We say, I feel lonely, but lonely is not a feeling. You want to change that to, when I'm lonely, I feel. For instance, when I'm lonely, I feel afraid that I will die if I'm alone. When I'm lonely, I'm angry that people have rejected me, or whatever. So I try to make the case that when we use simple words like sad, mad, scared, glad, that's when we're really dealing with our actual feelings and saying yes to them. And when we use words like, I was betrayed, I was abandoned, rejected, disappointed, humiliated, so forth, those are actually judgments about how other people have treated us, and they're not really our actual feelings. So this is a really important distinction because it brings us back to the bedrock realities of what we feel, and it's directly connected to the five givens of life because each of those five givens brings up these feelings. When things change and end, that means you're going to be sad, so you have to have it in you to be able to express that sadness without inhibition, because you're in a world where things are changing and ending, so it's useful to grieve. When we say something like, things don't always go according to plan, well, that may bring up anger. That may bring up sadness. You have to have it in you to be able to express those feelings. And these feelings, by the way, are actually our lively energy. This is what makes us the alive, exciting beings that we really are.
Yeah, their body.
We were given the impression wrongly, going all the way back to Plato, that a truly psychologically healthy person is one who lives rationally, that if I live in accord with reasonable, logical plans, that is the meaning of being a truly healthy person. That is leaving out the other half of us, because as Aristotle says, we are rational animals. So if you're only going to be rational, you're only half human. The other half is the animal part. The animal part is where those feelings are. And it has to be, and we finally have to grant hospitality to that side of ourselves. That's the true yes. It's the yes to your whole self and the yes to the whole shape that life takes. See how it all fits?
Yep. I do. I'd like to remind listeners, we're speaking today with David Rico, author of The Five Things We Cannot Change and The Happiness We Find by Embracing Them, out January 11th, with Shambhala as the publisher in most local bookstores, I'm sure. I'd like to quote you here. It's a kind of a long quote, but it's on the subject of our animal nature in a way. To show feelings.
What page are you on?
136. To show feelings with physical gestures and full bodily resonance helps us be true to the visceral nature of our experience. Society may frown on this kind of full or even florid expression of feeling, but the challenge of personal freedom is to design our behavior in accord with what is earthy and natural. We are rational animals, and yet we live mostly in our heads. Feelings help us grant hospitality to our instinctive, passionate, primal inclinations. They open the door so we can take more risks, be more defiant of the status quo, more daring in our imagination and behavior. To be rational is to be in control, and this may be why we feel safer in that realm and deny our citizenship in the animal kingdom. Feelings, along with dancing, shouting, joking, and other ventures outside the box, release our fuller nature. So just on, you know, bringing that, that animal part of ourselves in can release some good stuff. What I'm wondering is, when we're in touch with this animal visceral nature in ourselves and we witness, for example, the degradation of environmental policies which protect our ecosystems and the air we breathe, aren't we naturally moved to participate in a conscious stewardship of our world as, you know, animals of the planet in a way?
Yes. We'd be more likely to do that if we were in touch with this other side.
And I mean, isn't this an important thing? Can you comment a little bit on that, given, you know, the nature of what's going on in the world today?
Well, the way I see it is, as we recognize our place in as interconnected with everything else, when we're no longer so oriented toward taking care of ourselves, only when we see ourselves, as you said, as stewards of the world around us and even of the other people around us, I mean, that we all would watch out for each other, that we will tend then to take care of the earth better. And the way it's set up now is, what can I do to make sure I have all that I need, to make sure I have more and more money, more and more possessions, and we do that at the price of taking advantage of nature, usually. So this would make us, this new consciousness would make us more charitable, and we would live in accord with the sense of interconnectedness. We wouldn't act like we were alone. We would always take into account the world around us and what the needs are of nature and people, as opposed to only the needs for ourselves. So that's how I would see it.
Yeah, you say it is now clear that an engaged spirituality requires work in the world in a politically active role and simultaneously some distance from the workaday world in a contemplative mode. The contemplative has been less an issue for me as a spiritual seeker, but the political has really come into focus in the past 4 years or so. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, how you perceive the importance of the political within the context of a spiritual journey, and you kind of answered most of that. I think many, certainly of our listeners, are discouraged by the recent turn of political events and know the power of our country and its imperialistic leanings. Kind of in the face of those facts, what can spiritual seekers practice under these circumstances, according to, you know, your beliefs and feelings?
Well, first of all, I'm certainly with you on that. Secondly, it's such a good question because it brings us to another feature of this whole subject, which is, would I still be committed to doing all that I can do, even when I get indicators over and over that it is not effective? When you really have this commitment to the betterment of the world, then you keep working politically even when your candidate loses, then you wait for the next election and you do it again. It's the opposite of despair, in which you simply give up and no longer care. You go off to your, you know, monastic cell and just work on yourself. That is what despair means. It means that you no longer act in accord with your interconnected nature. Because we're all somehow joined in one mystical body of humanity. And we're all making a contribution to everyone else, and everyone else is making a contribution to us. So no matter how things turn out, like the recent election, we're still going to be working at ways to make our country better. We're not giving up just because things didn't turn out exactly the way we wanted them to. In fact, that's one of the givens, that things don't always turn out the way we want them to turn out.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how can one use the principles that you've set forth in your writings to commit themselves to, you know, that path or that Sangha aspect of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha?
Mm-hmm. I think you're referring to the three refuges that we take refuge in the Buddha, which is the wisdom that's in us, and we take refuge in the Dharma, which is a way of living that is loving and that is conscientious, and we take refuge in the Sangha, which is the community of people not only around us but in the whole world. And literally, it refers to the community of practitioners, but we're expanding it in our discussion here. It comes to one simple thing, which is never giving up, that I never give up on the possibility that things can change for the better, and I'm always acting in favor of that. When we're truly spiritually oriented, it's never giving up and going into your own personal cocoon. It's always remaining enormously connected to everything else, which reflects the reality of our nature. John Muir has a statement that I've always remembered. He said, when you try to look at one thing in nature, you notice that it's hitched up to everything else. So I see that as a comment on ourselves, too. When I look at David, Rico, I can't just look at David Rico because he only exists with his mother Louise, his father Dominic, his brother Joe, his sister Lois, the person next door, all my friends, you, Bella. I mean, it's any connection that's ever happened, plus the connection to all of humanity that I don't even know. It's just the essence of our humanness to be in continual connection and dialogue. So we want to move away from that old view of I just work out my own salvation with diligence. There would be no my own. It's all our own. So that would be a spiritual given.
Yeah.
And one that you have to have faith to believe in. I keep coming back to that.
Right, right.
Some of these things are not, we can't prove them scientifically. I mean, we can prove scientifically that there's an ecology and everything is connected to everything else. But when you say, well, I, as a human, am connected to all other humans, then it becomes kind of moves a little more into the religious realm.
Or the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get into something, but we're about ready to take a break. In fact, we probably could do that now and come back and get into something a little deeper. You're listening to Alternative Currents on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor, your community radio station, streaming live on the web at weru.org. Be back in a couple of minutes. Welcome back to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson, speaking today with Dave Rico, David Rico, author of many books, but his most recent, put out by Shambhala very soon, in another week or so from the date you're listening to this, The Five Things We Cannot Change and the Happiness We Find by Embracing Them. Dave, I want to read another quote of yours. This is a yes to who I am. More and more in the self-help movement, we are realizing that a truly healthy person is someone who is virtuous, too. For instance, to have self-esteem is a psychological accomplishment, but without humility, a virtue that results from spiritual practice, it is simply decorative and not authentically and deeply instilled. Psychological work does not motivate us toward loving kindness, toward a refusal to retaliate, or even toward integrity in our business dealings. For those virtues, we need a spiritual consciousness that complements our psychological work. On the other hand, spiritual practice does not help us process, grieve, and heal our childhood issues and so on. So that that going back and forth, doing the psychological work and practicing the loftier spiritual precepts is really, you know, it is hard in certain situations, you know, easier in some and tougher in others. Certainly about the things that we feel we can't change in our personal life, but the kind of global stuff is a little more challenging. You know, we can hear the Dalai Lama speak about nonviolence and peace and not retaliating, and then watch, you know, pictures of what's happening over in Iraq and so on. And it makes it, you know, for Westerners, I think it's a tough thing to kind of tie our hands up and shut our mouths and practice peace and advocate for peace in the face of something that looks that daunting. So I like the tools that you give. I think that they're important and if not critical for some of us to take a look at. I'm wondering about when we have coexisting emotions, or maybe we have a predominant emotion like anger at the injustice of something. At the same time, and I'm really able to do this as a person, you know, feeling really angry towards somebody for their actions, but also totally seeing them as, you know, a radiant human being and forgiving and loving them at the same time. But I think it's tough. And I'd like you to talk, a little bit about how you would help someone achieve this, because the mind, I think, can reject this as unreal. You know, if you've got two seemingly coexisting, seemingly opposing things coexisting at once, you know, how do we deal with this?
Okay. First of all, I understand what you're saying, and it's a good question. Anger is defined in the dictionary as displeasure at injustice. Now, this dictionary definition helps me a lot because, first of all, it makes anger much more accessible and legitimate, because we can all say we definitely feel displeasure about what we see as injustice. So to say I never feel angry is not really correct, because we certainly all feel displeasure at what seems to be unfair or unjust. So that's the first part of it, the legitimacy of the feeling. But the spiritual dimension comes in when you make certain decisions about how you will express the anger. So, for instance, anger usually is expressed with blame of the one that you person that you consider unjust. Also, you might retaliate against that person. Also, you might put that person down. Also, you might reject that person and push him away. Well, the spiritual side, the spiritual work that we've done on ourselves makes us look for anger as a practice, a spiritual practice in which we express the feeling in a direct and uninhibited way, but we no longer will stoop to retaliate, blame, put down, ridicule, reject. In other words, we take all, or be violent in some way. We take all those parts out of it. We say that, no, I'm following precepts that don't permit that, while at the same time, I do express the anger. I mean, it's such a wonderful possibility for us to realize that it's perfectly okay to have our feelings. And various spiritual traditions have given us tools that show us how to do that in a way that does not have to hurt others. Now, you said, well, at the same time, I'm continually remembering that this person in front of me has radiant Buddha-like energy, or Christ consciousness, however you want to put it. That's what happens automatically when you don't stoop to retaliation and so forth. You will always be able to maintain that connection. The anger doesn't break the connection, which it does through blame, retaliation, and violence. Instead, you'll notice that it just maintains itself because you're simply expressing displeasure at injustice, and you're simply expressing your own feeling without trying to hurt someone because he did the things that led to your feeling angry. He didn't cause the anger. He only provided the context in which it happened.
And here's the other piece I'm sure is right. You know, if it wasn't him, it would have been someone else. I mean, the human shadow has that about it. You know, it's not going to go away. And you speak to that also in this book and other works of yours about that, you know, the dark and the light playing off of one another. If you'd want to get into that too, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, also that we might feel like we don't like the political structure that we're in. We don't like the wars that are happening around us. We don't like the present administration. But we have to remember that all of this is a given of life in a democracy where people vote and they vote in a candidate and this candidate makes certain decisions and we may like them or not like them. But, and we may see it as a darker side. We may see the decisions as coming from a darker side than what most of us would want. But when we've made peace with the fact that that's just the nature of human living, that this will come up over and over in the course of history, it's not that we simply give up and go along with it, but we don't blame specific people around it. We see it as all part of, well, as a feature of collective life. That things happen that you don't like, that violent things happen, that's just the nature of the human story. It's always been part of our story. And I'm trying to put this in such a way that it doesn't sound like, oh, well, give up and go along with it.
Right, yeah. Can't we use that anger to motivate us to, you know, take appropriate action instead of...
Yes, exactly.
Sitting
in
down.
In other words, I'm thinking of that quotation by T.S. Eliot. I sat upon the shore with the arid wastes behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? In other words, I'm sitting in a world that I don't like. It's an arid wasteland in so many ways. But what about me? What do I do to get my little acre to look as good as it can? What contribution do I make along those lines? And I wouldn't stop there. I wouldn't say just, can I at least set my lands in order? I would go the next step, which is, how do I set my lands in order and the whole land in order?
Right.
Like if we're all taking full responsibility for everything as opposed to just personal responsibility for my own little acre. I mean, it's such a beautiful option because it takes those words of the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, and it says, I'm the shepherd. If I'm in the image of, if I'm made in the image and likeness of God, then I'm in, then I am the good shepherd, and that is my work. It isn't to depend on some help coming from the sky. It's that I've, that is now identifying who I am in the world.
And I think another important thing to realize, and it's, it really has again come and hit me right where I live in the past, you know, 4 years or so, is, I mean, we can't complain about violence and war if what we're doing at home, you know, what we're doing in our personal life is fighting and bickering and, you know, not doing our work with our partner or with our kids or whatever. So I think it's a good thing. It is what it is, but one of the better aspects of it is that it's really forced people like me, I think, to look even closer at cleaning up our own backyard, you know, to take care of that little acre or that corner of the world that we do have more say in, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've drawn again and again in your book. Again, listeners, we're speaking with Dave Rico, author of The Five Things We Cannot Change and The Happiness We Find by Embracing Them. The same author I interviewed a couple of years ago on How to Be an Adult in Relationships, still one of my most highly recommended books to friends and clients, definitely. Just because we're older doesn't mean we've become adults. I think most of us realize that in our relationships.
Doesn't happen just by age.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. Darn it. But anyway.
We're not like cheese.
Yeah.
Just a matter of aging.
Yeah, that's right. I like, again and again, I'm drawn into the, you know, the texture and the feeling of the emotion, you know, saying yes to the feelings. What are feelings? What is the lifespan of a feeling? Can you talk about that?
Yes. One of the reasons we fear feeling is because we imagine that we'll be out of control with the feeling, or the feeling will run away with us, not realizing that built into us humans is a very specific geometric figure. It's the bell-shaped curve. And so the lifespan of a feeling is to go over a bell-shaped curve. And I would describe it this way. First, you are aroused to a feeling, and then you feel it and crest with it, and then you come down the other side of this bell-shaped curve, and the feeling starts to lose its potency and to decline, and you go back to baseline. So, for instance, some people are afraid of expressing anger because they say, I don't know what I would do. I might be violent. I might, you know, go out of control. If you join, and that's true, but if you join your spiritual practices as we've been describing to your anger, then it happens just as a normal feeling happens. You will be aroused by an injustice to feel the displeasure of anger. You will express this anger directly in a vivid and lively way. And then, after you express it, your body automatically releases and lets go, and you come back to a kind of serenity. Now, when you don't express the feeling, when you simply let it be aroused, but you don't do anything with it because you want to be nice or you want to be polite or you're afraid of the consequences, then that feeling gets stuffed within you and becomes a source of stress. So I'm trusting that if you go with a feeling, it will be relatively brief and it will bring you to a place of serenity. Whereas when you avoid them, you just add stress because they pile up inside and they don't get a chance to go over their bell-shaped curve.
Right.
So that's the idea of it. The longest of our feelings is grief, and the shortest is anger. Anger happens and could happen just being Italian. I saw anger expressed in like just a minute. And then a minute later, they were, you know, the angry person was hugging you. So I can assure you they can be short.
Yeah.
And so, grief is the longest one, can go on for years, and that's appropriate. Its bell-shaped curve could take even a lifetime.
I think it was you who, and it might not have been, but during an interview you spoke about how in the Middle East, you know, anger is the shortest emotion and grief is the longest emotion, but that in this country it's a little bit reversed. You know, we're supposed to get over the grief really fast.
Yes.
And the anger is what we hold on to. So
exactly.
It's interesting how that works. So come back. I mean, we can talk about spirituality all we want, and spirituality really is a practice more than to be talked about. But, you know, the emotional stuff, I think, is just, it's something that a lot of spiritual seekers bypass somehow or don't feel like they've got to really work on or process. Or, you know, if you say enough prayers or meditate long enough or go on enough retreats, you're not going to have those feelings come up again and again.
Yes, that's exactly why I put that whole chapter in there on feelings. And also I suspect that the reason we fight these givens of life, the things we cannot change, and I listed the five.
Which are, again?
Everything changes and ends. Things do not always go according to our plans. Life is not always fair. Suffering is part of everyone's life, and people are not loving and loyal all the time toward us. Now, in a way, all of those bring up grief because things aren't going the way we want them to go. So I imagine that the fear of grief is what makes us want to be in control of things so that they don't change, so that things are fair, so that people are loving, loyal, so forth, so that we don't have to suffer. The reason we're fighting these givens is because we don't want to feel the grief that results from them. And the reason we're trying so hard to be in full control is because of the fear that if we let go and simply say yes to what is as it is, we'll have to feel a lot of feelings, especially grief. So I'm making that connection between how controlling we are and how afraid we are. I don't think we're being controlling because we're bad people or even because we want to be in control. I think we're trying to stay in control because we're afraid of what life would be like if we weren't in control. And then, of course, you find out that you're not in control anyway. And so it becomes very frustrating.
Yeah, I think
a losing game.
Yeah. I think another piece, too, I was talking to someone just last night who is realizing more and more that they're tired of bringing drama back into their lives, or what Eckhart Tolle calls the reactivation of the pain body. Mm-hmm. And so they keep bringing this back in, and all of a sudden, what they're feeling is nothing. And that's really freaking this person out. And I think that's another thing. I mean, it's one thing to feel emotions. It's another thing to enter that place of stillness and that void and have that be a comfortable thing as well.
Mm-hmm. I guess the idea is, how can I make room for what I feel? And you put your finger on it when you indicated before that some of us are getting the impression that in order to be spiritual, it means you don't have emotions. This doesn't square with a statement I just heard from the Dalai Lama, who was asked the question, well, with all your spiritual practices, what is it that, you know, still kind of bothers you? And he said, it's the fact that I'm quick to anger. Hmm. That I was never able to do much with. So the first thing I thought was, oh, so even he feels anger. So at least we have that.
Yeah, got that.
Secondly,
going for us.
He's saying it's okay to be angry, but just not quick to anger. Always allow yourself a pause where you, you know, make sure that you're coming across in a way that aligns with your spiritual practices, so that I want to express this in a way that doesn't hurt anyone. But in true spirituality, it's about wholeness, and the whole person is the person who does feel things and is impacted by events. So to think that spirituality means there will be no impact would make spirituality about being dead, not being alive, because to be alive is to be impacted. So how can I be impacted but not devastated? How can I feel my feelings but not have them run away with me, or not let them obsess or possess me?
Or run
how
away.
Can I simply hold them and then express them in a way that is appropriate to what the feeling is about? For instance, if it's sadness, how can I shed my tears? If it's anger, how can I raise my voice and speak up? If it's fear, how can I kind of quake a little bit and feel jittery? Is it okay with me that I'm like that, or would I feel that that's somehow not okay? The more spiritual you are, the more okay you are with this human body that you were given.
Yeah, we're sitting with, that's one thing to sit in meditation with nothingness. It's another thing to sit with a strong feeling and not run for, you know, something to cover it up or dull it down or, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Even
and we
if,
use alcohol and drugs, of course, for that.
And
for
meditation sometimes,
purpose.
I think. I think some people actually use spirituality for it.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, let's get me into the zone again. So, you know, yeah.
Yeah, to think that meditation is about learning to relax, which is only one of the possible results, but the real purpose of it is to align yourself with reality. And that will mean that I'm even more impacted by the events that happen. I'm even more vulnerable, more touched by what goes on, as opposed to, oh, I found ways so that nothing hurts me anymore.
Right. Yeah, you talked about that a little bit, your personal story about feeling vulnerable or feeling open as a man, you know, what your front used to be. I can't remember where in the book it was, but that touched me. To just allow, you know, ourselves to be that open and that that vulnerable, in especially in a safe relationship,
mm-hmm.
Certainly yeah. is not non-spiritual. There's a double negative for you.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly
mm-hmm.
is a spiritual practice. In the chapter, Yes to Who I Am, I really like how you broke down. A kind of checklist to track progress toward psychological health, toward spiritual health, and so on. What is a mystic?
A mystic refers to a person who has a direct personal experience of the infinite, or God, or higher power, universe, without the need for mediators. So, for instance, in Christian tradition, the mystic saints were the ones who had visions and intuitions and experiences of God that did not require the need for the church and the sacraments. So that's why mystics have always been suspect in the official church. The saints were still members of the church and believers in the sacraments and so forth, but they had personal experiences which were often contradictory to the ones that they were taught. In the book, I give a very specific example, which I've always loved. It's a statement by Juliana of Norwich. She's a 14th century English mystic. And I'll give the quote as best I can. She said, "Holy Church taught me that the sinners will burn in hell for all eternity. But this did not match my vision. In my vision, Jesus was incapable of punishment and loved sinners and saints alike." Now that's an example of a mystical realization that does not square with the ordinary teachings that most of us were brought up with, which is that the innocent will be, that the good people will be rewarded and the innocent and the evil people or the sinners will be punished forever. And from that, of course, you get heaven and hell. But once you say yes to the givens of life, one of the givens being that it doesn't work that way, that pain is not punishment and happiness is not reward, and that there is no realm in which everything will be finally squared and they will get theirs. Having that in your heart is a wish to hurt others and to retaliate. It's the opposite of true spirituality. So you finally, as you become more spiritually oriented, you finally let go of that. That's what happened to Juliana of Norwich. She had an actual realization, which she calls a vision, an actual realization that, oh, it isn't set up on the basis of retaliation. This universe is set up on the basis of love and mercy, and it's granted to all, no matter what they have done. You see how radical that is?
Certainly for that time.
And it doesn't satisfy that little ego inside of us, I should say big ego, inside of us that wants to make sure that they get theirs and that I get rewarded for how nice I am. And as long as we're caught in that punishment retaliation cycle, we're never really free to love
ourselves or anybody else.
Yeah.
So, again, in the chapter, Yes to Who I Am, a checklist of, you know, how we're progressing in our psychological work and spiritual work, and finally, mystical consciousness, which I thought was a nice place to go for those of us who really don't identify with any particular religious belief, but kind of, you know, draw from what we need to draw from. And just live as best we can with the awarenesses that we have.
Everything is so big now, we can't limit none of us can safely limit ourselves to one tradition, even if we were brought up in one religion. It would be foolish to get everything from that one source, given all the big, new, wonderful sources that we're now aware of, especially since the invention of the computer. I mean, we have so much access to all the traditions and what they offer that how could we think for a minute that we could possibly be okay limiting ourselves to just one source? I mean, it just no longer makes sense.
Yeah. Right. I like the Paul Tillich quote in your epilogue. "Sometimes it happens that we receive the power to say yes to ourselves, that peace enters into us whole, that self-hate and self-contempt disappear, and that our self is reunited with itself, then we can say that grace has come upon us. Are there any closing comments that you have?
Well, I would just like to comment on grace, since you mentioned it from Paul Tillich's quote, that an important feature of spiritual maturity is realizing that all of our practices do not lead to our becoming whole or our becoming better. That also required is a grace that comes to us from the universe, from a higher power, from something that's bigger than our ego, that helps us do the work, and that wants us to do the work. So everything in the universe is tensed in the direction of our becoming the best we can be, so that we can all evolve together in this one mystical body of humanity. And it doesn't happen only because of the effort that I put in. It also happens because something beyond effort, which in religious and spiritual terms is called grace. Grace is the Latin word for free. That a free gift of special quantum leap is granted to us at various times. We have no control over when it will happen. But there are those wonderful, miraculous moments in which we access a wonderful power to show virtue or to see things wisely. And we knew that we didn't know that before or have it in us to do that before. But something came through and kind of kicked us upstairs so that we acted in a way that was bigger and better than we ever thought we had in us. And to me, that's the most exciting feature of spirituality, that we're in a world of givens that we don't always like, but that at the same time, with every given comes graces that help us live with that given and make the best of it and come through it in an even more as even more wonderful beings than we ever were before. And when you see these graces happening, that's what helps you realize that you don't have to look down on yourself or look at yourself with contempt. In fact, I'm thinking of a line from Walt Whitman. There is a lot of me, and all so luscious.
And on that parting quote, thanks so much for being with us today on Alternative Currents.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Wish you well on the upcoming book. We've again been speaking on Alternative Currents today with David Rico, author of The Five Things We Cannot Change and the Happiness We Find by Embracing Them, out to January 11th, published by Shambhala, should be widely available. Feel free to go to David's website, daverico.com. He's also having online classes on relationships, which involve several different things. You might want to go to teachingassistant.com and then to Dave Rico's website, daverico.com. Thanks for listening. And if any of you are interested in getting a reminder as to what shows are coming up month to month, you're welcome to tap in to my website, bellajohnson.com, bellajohnson.com. Go to the contact page and email me, and I'll gladly add you to that list. Thanks for being patient listeners today, and talk to you again first Friday next month, 10 a.m.